puppets than living, breathing people. It may be that not knowing where you're going is easier than planning ahead. Not knowing where you're going may even lead to a more satisfying ending. You may also find that your ending arises effortlessly and organically from the situation and the characters as a natural and inevitable result of your choices along the way. Of course, with this method, you may also find that you have painted yourself into a corner or have drafted a narrative that just peters out. Either way, you're running the risk of having to go back and start again, but hey, that's showbiz. Way back in the second lecture, I talked about how literature is the creation of order out of chaos, the creation of meaning out of an otherwise meaningless existence. The ending of a narrative is where that meaning is most sharply defined. The ending is where the hidden patterns are finally revealed. The ending is where, at least for a fleeting moment, we understand everything that came before. In other words, perhaps the secret of a satisfying ending of any variety is not that it's definitive or revelatory or happy or unhappy. Perhaps the secret of a satisfying ending is that there's nothing left to say. With the next lecture, I'll be starting a block of three lectures about point of view. In the first lecture, I'll be talking in general about the wide range of points of view, touching briefly on a variety of works, including George Eliot's Middlemarch, Marilynne Robinson's Housekeeping, and Nabokov's Lolita. In the meantime, here's an exercise to help you think about crafting an ending. Take a story or a novel you really love and imagine a different ending for it. Then work back to see what you'd have to change to make the new ending believable and satisfying. Take Jane Eyre as an example. Jot down a rough outline of everything in the book that leads to Jane's marriage to Mr. Rochester. Then imagine a different ending. Perhaps she marries someone else in the novel, or she decides to go live by herself on her inheritance money. Then go back through the outline and see what you'd have to change in the story to make the new ending work. And how can you tell I have reached the end of this lecture? Because I have nothing left to say.
Lecture 15, Seeing Through Other Eyes, Point of View.
As I said in my earlier lectures about character, fiction gives us access to the consciousness of other people. This is just another way of saying that fiction allows us to see the world from someone else's point of view. Point of view is just as fundamental to fiction as character and plot. It's hard, if not impossible, to imagine a work of fiction without any characters in it, and by the same token, it's pretty much impossible to imagine a work of fiction that has no point of view. Even the most remote third-person narrative, which watches human behavior without judgment as if through a security camera, is a particular point of view. Just as there are different ways to create character or structure a plot, there are a wide variety of points of view. There's the imperial, godlike third person of the great 19th century authors such as George Eliot or Leo Tolstoy. There's the intimate, limited third person of a high modernist novel like Mrs. Dalloway, shifting from one character to the next. Or there's the distinctive first person of books as different from each other as Jane Eyre, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Heart of Darkness, Lolita, or Housekeeping. Choosing a point of view is not just about deciding whether to use the third person or the first person. Choosing a point of view also determines the style and tone of the narration, specifically the quality that writers call voice. Think about a favorite novel or short story, especially one that is narrated in the first person, and I'll bet that what you remember mainly is the narrator's voice. Long after most of us have forgotten the plot details of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, we remember the sly, slangy voice of Huck himself. We remember Jane Eyre's grit and restrained passion. We remember Humbert Humbert's creepy erudition in Lolita. Each one of these individual voices not only evokes the character who was telling the story, it also determines the tone, sensibility, and moral stance of the narrative. Jane Eyre's decency and stubborn determination aren't just a reflection of her own personality. They represent Charlotte Bronte's view of what people are like and how the world works. It's important to remember that Mark Twain is not Huck Finn, and that Charlotte Bronte is not Jane Eyre, and that Nabokov is not Humbert Humbert. In the next lecture, I'll talk more about the double consciousness of the first-person narrator. It's even possible for a writer to create a first-person narrator who may not be telling the truth, the way Eudora Welty does in her short story, Why I Live at the P.O. I'll also talk about that technique known as an unreliable narrator in the next lecture. But as distinctive as a first-person narration can be, it's not as if first-person narrators have all the fun. A third-person narration can have as distinctive a voice as a first-person narrator. One of the great hallmarks of a great author, in fact, is the way his or her distinctive voice can become another character in the narrative, even if that voice isn't actually participating in the story. You can't read Dickens, for example, without coming away with a vivid impression of the author himself, even when he's writing in the third person, maybe even especially when he's writing in the third person. His great novel, Bleak House, is written in both the first and the third person, and you can't read it without getting a vivid idea of which characters Dickens approves of and which ones he doesn't. It's clear what makes Dickens angry, what makes him laugh, and what he thinks is the moral thing to do. His unique view of humanity, expressed with his boundless energy, is present on every page. George Eliot's great novel, Middlemarch, is written in the third person, but it also features frequent comments directly from the author. As a result, when you read Middlemarch, you're not only following the characters in the story, you're engaging with one of the sharpest and least sentimental intellects in English literature. And if you read Bleak House and Middlemarch one right after the other, and that's a lot of reading because they are both great big books, you can see right away that you could never mistake Eliot's voice for Dickens's or vice versa. As I keep reminding you throughout these lectures, writing fiction is all about making choices. When it comes to point of view, you have to decide whether your story will be told by someone in the story or by an outside narrator. You also have to decide what voice that character or that narrator is going to use. Choosing a point of view and a voice not only determines the perspective from which the story and the plot are viewed, it also determines which characters you include and how you depict them, as well as what actually happens in the narrative. Choosing a point of view is one of the most important decisions you will make. In this lecture, I want to take a quick tour of the most important types of point of view. Then, in the next two lectures, we'll look at the first-person point of view and then the third-person point of view in more detail. I have found that it sometimes helps to think of point of view as something literal, as a way of looking at a landscape, for example. Imagine your setting is an actual landscape with plains, mountains, valleys, forests, and deserts. Your story is what happens to your characters as they move across this landscape. Let's think of the different types of point of view as actual points along the curve of the sky arching over the story, from the highest point overlooking the entire landscape to the lowest point right down at ground level, where a character or a narrator can only see what's directly in front of him or her. Let's start with the third-person point of view. As we'll discover in more detail in a subsequent lecture, there are different types of third-person. The most all-inclusive variety is the third-person omniscient point of view, right at the zenith of our metaphorical sky. This is the point of view in which the author and the narrator seem to be more or less the same person, though that's not necessarily the case. As John Gardner puts it, the omniscient narrator is a persona of the author. Whether or not this narrator is the same person as the author, this sort of narration sees all and is capable of revealing everything there is to know about the characters. This point of view is often called godlike because the narration is like an all-powerful, all-knowing deity who can not only see the entire landscape beneath, but into the hearts and minds of its characters. This type of narration can place a character in her historical, political, and social context at the same time, as it can reveal her most intimate secrets. This variety of the third-person point of view is often associated with the 19th century, when it was used without irony by such great writers as George Eliot and Leo Tolstoy. With the rise of modernism and postmodernism, the omniscient point of view came to be used more ironically. Even so, it was the point of view that dominated fiction right through the middle of the 20th century, often in large-scale novels that have a lot of characters and often evoke whole communities. A good example is Paula Marshall's The Chosen Place, The Timeless People, an epic novel about life on a Caribbean island which was published in 1969. More recently, Jonathan Franzen, in his novels The Corrections and Freedom, has adopted a godlike point of view. So has the British novelist Nicola Barker in her novel Darkmans, which depicts the members of a community even as it enters into the consciousness of each of its characters as intimately as Mrs. Dalloway does. A little closer to the ground along our curve of sky, but still pretty high up, is the third-person objective point of view. We've already encountered a good example of this point of view in Dashiell Hammett's detective novel, The Maltese Falcon. As I said when we were discussing this novel earlier, the interesting thing about the point of view of the Maltese Falcon is that we see and hear everything each character does, but we never get inside their heads. The omniscient third person of Tolstoy or Eliot can dip into the heads of an individual character like Anna Karenina or Dorothea Brooke and inhabit her consciousness for a time, showing us what she is thinking and feeling. But the objective third person is more like a video camera. It records and reports everything it sees, but it doesn't tell us anything about the character's private feelings, thoughts, or motivations. This point of view may even be the most lifelike one. After all, we can't read the minds of other people in real life, and the objective point of view reproduces what it feels like as we try to guess, from their speech, actions, and gestures, what other people around us are thinking. But even though it's more lifelike than the third-person omniscient, it's also a colder point of view, because it cannot engage intimately with the minds of its characters. Now, moving down along the dome of our imaginary sky, we find a spot about halfway down, midway between the omniscient third-person and the most intimate first-person narration. This point of view is known as the close third-person or the limited third-person. More recently, it has also come to be known as free indirect discourse. In the close third person, the narration uses third-person pronouns such as he, she, and they, instead of first-person pronouns such as I or we. And like the omniscient third person, it gets inside the heads of its characters. But in the limited third person, the whole story or novel is generally told from the point of view of only one character. John Updike, for example, used the close third person in his series of four novels about the life of Harry Rabbit Angstrom. These novels are written in the third person, but they are mainly told from the point of view of Rabbit himself. The close third person, in fact, is the default mode of much contemporary fiction. But the close third person doesn't have to be limited to one character. Often, writers will alternate the points of view between several characters within the same narrative, the way Toni Morrison does in Beloved. William Faulkner's Light in August also shifts between several different point of view characters, all of them expressed in the third person. In fact, the close third person point of view can easily turn into the omniscient third person. Much of George Eliot's Middlemarch, for example, is written from the point of view of one character or another, but Eliot often shifts into the omniscient point of view, often within a chapter or even within a paragraph. However, the traditional omniscient third person is usually more remote from its characters and capable of making sweeping judgments about society or whole classes of people. For whatever reason, modern novels written in the more intimate close third person tend to shy away from those kinds of judgments. Still, the close third person allows the author to pull back the camera if he wants to. It allows him to comment directly on the action or to show us something the point of view character can't or doesn't know. Moving further down the curve of the sky, the close third person shades into what you might call the objective first person. Like the close third person, which uses third person pronouns to limit itself to the perspective of one character, the objective first person is a hybrid point of view. It uses the first person pronoun I, but still maintains a certain distance from the action of the narrative. In other words, In the objective first person, the story or novel is being narrated by a fictional character, but one who either plays only a minor part in the story or isn't actually present in the story at all. Two good examples are Ishmael in Moby Dick and Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby. In much of Moby Dick, Ishmael acts mainly as a recording eye, telling what he sees and hears, even though he's technically a crew member of the Pequod and a character in the story. He involves himself in the work of the crew, but his story is not the main story of the book, and he is not the main character. Captain Ahab is. Instead of taking center stage, Ishmael does two things. One is to tell us the story of Captain Ahab's obsession with the great white whale. The other is to evoke, almost like a documentary filmmaker, the way of life aboard a whaling vessel. In the second half of the novel, in fact, much of Ishmael's narration is, in effect, in the third person. There are even scenes that take place when Ishmael isn't even present. In The Great Gatsby, Nick Carraway is slightly more important to the story. The character of Daisy is his cousin, and he plays a role in bringing Gatsby and Daisy together over the course of the book. Furthermore, it's Nick's voice that passes judgment on the events of the story, and it's his voice that sums up the meaning of the book in those famous final lines. But the main story is not about Nick. It's about Gatsby and Daisy. You could easily imagine a version of The Great Gatsby written in the third person, where Nick is just a minor character, and F. Scott Fitzgerald himself takes on the responsibility of passing judgment at the end. A variant of this type of first person is the first person plural narration, in which the author uses the pronoun we and adopts the collective point of view of a community of people. One of the best known examples is William Faulkner's famous Gothic short story, A Rose for Emily, which is narrated from the point of view of the town itself. In this classic story, the first person plural has the effect of drawing the reader in and making her a de facto member of the community. In fact, the complicity implied in the use of the pronoun we has the further effect of making the story's chilling ending even more shocking. The first person plural isn't used very often, but it's still a technique that can generate interesting results. In recent years, the American writer Joshua Ferris wrote his first novel, Then We Came to the End, from the point of view of a group of office workers at a Chicago advertising agency. Now let's move along the curve of the sky as far down as we can go. Here, right down at ground level, is the subjective first person. In this point of view, the first person narrator is one of the main characters in the story and often the main character. Unlike Ishmael in Moby Dick, who is the narrator but not the main character, Huck Finn is both the narrator and the main character of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. We see and hear everything in the book through Huck's eyes, and we can only know what Huck witnesses or hears about. Not only that, but Huck's moral journey is the heart of the novel, as he befriends the escaped slave Jim and decides not to turn him in to the authorities. In more recent times, as the subjective first person has become more prevalent, we have narrators like Ruth in Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping. Ruth is one of the three main characters in the book, and her decision about how she wants to live her life represents the book's climax. And there's the chilling Humbert Humbert in Nabokov's Lolita, who tells us of his illicit passion for the 12-year-old Dolores Hayes. This is one of the most disturbing uses of the subjective first person in all of literature. The curve of sky representing the different points of view is a continuum, of course, and these are just the principal compass points on it. Narratives can and do find points in between the ones I've just described. For example, a first-person narrator can be an unreliable narrator who lies or withholds certain crucial information or misunderstands what's actually going on. And many books mix and match points of view. In Anna Karenina and Middlemarch, both Tolstoy and George Eliot vary the scope of their third person. Sometimes they give us a wide-angle, omniscient view encompassing whole groups or communities of people. But sometimes they use the limited third person to get deep inside the head of a single character. Tolstoy, for example, goes so deep inside Anna's head near the climax of Anna Karenina that he approaches the extremely intimate third person you find in high modernist novels like Mrs. Dalloway. Some books jump back and forth between the third and first person. Dickens' great novel, Bleak House, is told from both the third person and the first person point of view. Even more recently, John Burnham Schwartz's novel, Reservation Road, has three main characters, two of whom we hear from in the first person, while the third character we see only in the close third person. When you're deciding on the point of view of your story, however, you're not just deciding who tells it. There's also the question of to whom the writer is telling the story, as well as the question of the time and distance from which a story is told. Let's take these one at a time. When I say that you have to consider to whom a story is told, I'm not talking about trying to decide who your audience is. That's a different question, and not necessarily an artistic one. Rather, I'm talking about a different question. Is your narration addressed to an unknown reader in the real world, or is it addressed to some one person or some group of people who exist in the world of the story? Take, for example, three of the most famous first-person narratives in literary history: Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and Nabokov's Lolita. In the first two examples, the narrator is the title character. In Lolita, the narrator is the poet Humbert Humbert, and the title character is the 12-year-old girl who is the object of his sexual obsession. In all three examples, there are at least hints that the character is aware that he or she is addressing the actual reader of the book. Jane Eyre narrates her own story with great force and intimacy, as if she were writing her memoir for posterity. In the novel's single most famous line, she makes it clear that she knows she's writing a book when she says about Mr. Rochester, "Reader, I married him." Here you have one of the most memorable examples of a fictional character speaking directly to the real readers of her book, or seeming to. What's really happening, of course, is that Charlotte Bronte, a real person, is causing Jane Eyre, a fictional person, to speak directly to the reader. Or, if you prefer a more mystical interpretation, Jane Eyre is speaking through Charlotte Bronte. Huck Finn bridges the gap between fiction and reality in his very first sentence. "You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer." In this case, a fictional character not only speaks directly to the reader, he refers to a real book by the real author in which he, Huck, first appears as a fictional character. Again, of course, it's not really Huck, but Mark Twain, using Huck to refer to himself and his own earlier book. In Lolita, Humbert Humbert's first-person narrative is a little less philosophically complex. The book opens with an introduction by a fictional psychiatrist, and the rest of the novel is written as a confession of his crimes that Humbert Humbert wrote in prison. Unlike Jane Eyre and Huck Finn, who cross the divide between the fictional world and the real world, Humbert Humbert remains constrained within the pages of his book. He knows he's writing something that may only ever be read by the authorities who locked him away. The question of a book's intended reader gets even more complicated when you consider first-person narrators who speak in the present tense. We often find this kind of narration in thrillers. "I walk into the room and pull my gun," that sort of thing. Such a narration contributes to the pace and immediacy of an exciting story, but there's something fundamentally improbable about it. Are we to understand that the character is silently narrating what he's doing as he does it? And then there are the first-person narrators of historical novels. Robert Graves' I, Claudius and Marguerite Yourcenar's Memoirs of Hadrian are fictional memoirs by real Roman emperors. We are meant to believe that Claudius and Hadrian are speaking explicitly to posterity, to readers who may live centuries after the author himself has died. The uses of the third person can be just as diverse. The 19th century third person omniscient voice of George Eliot and Leo Tolstoy is very much a public, authoritative voice. While you wouldn't mistake Eliot or Tolstoy for each other, they share a certain godlike distance from the story and their characters. The voice of Dickens, however, is more feverish and engaged in the lives of his characters, even though he also often writes in the third person. There are also third-person narrations that presume the reader's intimacy with the social setting and the worldview of the author. Take, for example, the famous first line of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Now, Austin was an ironic writer, so presumably even she understood the hyperbole of this statement. Outside of early 19th century Britain, and a very narrow slice of British society at that, this is patently not a universal truth. But even if you don't believe it, the first sentence implicates the reader in Austin's world right from the very first words. Moving into the 20th century, you have the stream of consciousness third person of such books as Mrs. Dalloway. Much of that book doesn't feel as though it's speaking to anyone outside of Mrs. Dalloway's head, let alone outside of the novel. Even though the novel is technically in the third person, the effect of reading Mrs. Dalloway's narrative voice is like eavesdropping on a character's thoughts in real time. With a first-person narrator, you have to decide just how close the narrator is to the events he or she is describing. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is told mainly in the past tense, but that famous opening sentence is told in the present tense. You don't know about me without you have read a book called The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. The clear implication of Huck's particular voice throughout the book is that he, the narrator, is still a boy, and he is telling us about a series of events that happened very recently. In other words, it's a story about a child told by the child. He's telling us about more or less contemporary events. It is a past tense story told by a present tense narrator, or a narrator who is speaking to us as we're reading. You get a slightly different effect from Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. The narrator of that novel is Scout, who was a child during the events of the novel, but who is remembering them from the perspective of an adult. At times, her narration is immediate and limited to what she knew when the events were actually happening. At other times, the novel steps back and narrates the events from the point of view of a grown woman, looking back on her childhood. In this respect, you might say we get the best of both worlds. A child's eye view of childhood, leavened with an adult's perspective on the events that the young scout would not have fully understood. It's a very subtle and sophisticated use of voice, and one of the elements of the book that accounts for its continuing popularity. In Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping, the narrator announces herself in the first person, present tense, in the book's first line, "My name is Ruth." But the rest of the book is told in a retrospective past tense. Even more so than Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, Ruth is clearly telling the story from the point of view of a grown woman at a distance of many years. And in Thomas Berger's epic western Little Big Man, the narrator, Jack Crabb, speaks about events that happened a lifetime ago, including his friendship with Wild Bill Hickok, his days as a gunfighter, and his life among the Sioux. This gives his narration the quality of a tall tale. Among other things, Jack Crabb claims to be the only white survivor of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and it helps define Jack himself as a talkative old man who loves spinning yarns. The idea of a narration's temporal distance from the events in the narrative is just as important with third-person narratives. The past tense is the default tense of many novels and stories, but the use of the past tense doesn't necessarily mean the events of the story took place in the distant past. For example, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina is told in the past tense, but it was both written and set during the 1870s. George Eliot's Middlemarch, on the other hand, was published in the early 1870s, but it was set 40 years earlier, in the 1830s. Tolstoy is using the past tense to tell a contemporary story, while Eliot is using a similar past tense to tell a story of the recent past, giving the reader some distance from the events. If you transfer this difference to the present day, you can see that one use of the past tense is significantly different from the other. Consider the difference between watching the two television shows Breaking Bad and Mad Men. Breaking Bad is set more or less in the present moment, forcing the viewer to confront the fact that Walter White's desperation and increasingly bad behavior are a result of a way of life in which we all participate. Mad Men, on the other hand, is set half a century in the past. This distance allows the viewer to look back on Don Draper's lies and infidelities with the smugness of hindsight. Breaking Bad jangles our nerves because there's no temporal distance between the story and us. This is how we live now. But with Mad Men, we can at least cling to the illusion that we are better behaved than the people who worked on Madison Avenue in the early 1960s. So, as if choosing among all the myriad possibilities for creating character and sketching out a plot weren't complicated enough, you have to contend with all the complicated choices that come with deciding what point of view to use and which voice to use. Do you want to survey the landscape from a great height? Do you want to try and encompass as wide a view as possible, showing the whole scope of society while diving at will into the heads of a variety of characters? Or do you only want to look at that little patch of territory you can see at ground level from the point of view of a single character? Do you want to adopt the godlike authority of a third-person past-tense narration that sees and understands all? Or do you want a first-person past-tense narrator who can look back with more experience on her younger self? Or do you want a third-person present-tense narration that relates events as they happen with no hint of what's coming? It's a lot to think about, so here's an exercise that might help you sort things out. Take the opening of any of the books I talked about in this lecture, or the opening of a book of your own choosing, or the opening of something you've written yourself, and try it in a different point of view, a different verb tense, a different voice. Would Huck Finn work if it were narrated in the third person? What if it were narrated by an elderly Huck looking back on his childhood? Would George Eliot be able to create as broad a portrait of the community in Middlemarch if it were narrated by only one character within the story? What would I, Claudius, feel like if it was written in the present tense? Would it make the Roman emperor's court feel more immediate, or would it just feel bizarre? I don't know if these alternate versions would be better or worse, but they would certainly be different than the ones we know. In the next lecture, I'll take a more detailed look at the first person, and I'll be talking again about Ishmael in Moby Dick and Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby. But I'll also be talking about unreliable narrators in the works of Henry James, Eudora Welty, and Mohsin Hamid. Then, in the following lecture, we'll look at the varieties of the third person. Each of these points of view has its advantages and disadvantages, and by exploring their use in the work of other authors, you'll be able to think about how to use different types of point of view and voice in your own work.
Lecture 16. I, me, mine. First person point of view.
There is something inherently improbable about a first person narrator. How often in real life have you ever listened to someone tell you a story about themselves that included not only their thoughts and actions, but elaborate evocations of the setting, not to mention verbatim dialogue from other people? Not very often, I'm guessing. As I said in my lecture about evocation, most people in real life tell stories the way they tell jokes, with just enough detail to get the point across. But in fiction, first-person narrators often pay attention to the purely literary requirements of setting a scene. They evoke sights and sounds and feelings, and they vividly render other characters. And if that narrator is in a novel, the first person becomes even more improbable, because the narrator is likely to go on without interruption for 100,000 words. In case you're wondering, that would take about 12 hours to speak aloud. In the preface to one of his novels, the American writer Henry James summed up the inherent improbability of the first-person narration when he said how strange it was to make a narrator both hero and historian of his own story. In other words, a first-person narration is peculiar because it has to do two things at once. It has to tell the story, but it also has to evoke one of the story's characters. And in many cases, the narrator is the story's most important character. What can make it even more peculiar is the fact that the narrator and the author don't always see eye to eye. As we'll see, this can lead to some interesting results. But in spite of its fundamental weirdness, or maybe even because of it, a first-person narration can be one of the most intimate, seductive, and natural-seeming ways to tell a story if it's done well. Certain varieties of third-person narration have an authoritative, public voice, think of George Eliot or Tolstoy, which can make you feel as if you're being lectured to as part of a large audience. but a first-person narrator can feel as if he or she is speaking to you alone, confiding his or her story to you and to no one else. This is what happened to me, the narrator is telling you. I saw this with my own eyes. A first-person narration can offer the reader the same feeling of immediacy and truthfulness we get when we hear testimony in a court case, read an intimate memoir, or, God forbid, sneak a peek at someone else's diary. And because a fictional character has the potential to reveal more of him or herself than any real person possibly could, a first-person narration can offer you an experience that you usually can't get in real life. This intimacy accounts for the deep affection we feel for certain famous fictional narrators. Consider how badly we want Jane Eyre to come up trumps and marry Mr. Rochester. Consider how much we want Huckleberry Finn to do the right thing and help the slave Jim gain his freedom. And consider how many people love J.D. Salinger's Holden Caulfield for his bluntness and his smart-alecky wit. But even so, this intimacy is still not real. A first-person narrator is an arbitrary literary conceit that is mutually agreed upon by the writer and the reader. It creates an illusion of intimacy that requires, on the part of the writer, fidelity to the voice of the narrator, not only as the source of the story, but as a character within the story. On the part of the reader, this illusion of intimacy requires a willingness to go along with the fantasy that this fictional person is real and telling you the truth. On the one hand, you have the inherent improbability of hearing a complex story told to you by one of its participants, and, on the other, you have the illicit thrill of hearing something that no one else knows. The tension between these two factors accounts for much of the power and the mystery of the first person. In this lecture, I want to look at several different varieties of first-person narrator and talk about how you can use each of them. Let's start with the least intimate variety. In the previous lecture, I called this the objective first person, or the first person narrator as recording I. This is a narrator who is present in the story, but who is not the most important character. In the continuum of points of view, an objective first person narrator is about halfway between the close third person and a more intimate first person. The narrator's role in telling the story is more important than his or her role in creating character. The most obvious examples from American literature are Ishmael in Moby Dick and Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby. Ishmael, of course, introduces himself to the reader in the very first line of the novel, "Call Me Ishmael," and early in the book we hear a great deal about his experiences. But it becomes obvious pretty quickly that the book is more about Captain Ahab than it is about anyone else. As it turns out, not only is Ahab more interesting than Ishmael, most of the characters in the book are more interesting than Ishmael. In fact, one of the curious things about Moby Dick is that its first-person narrator simply disappears for pages at a time. There are scenes in the novel where Ishmael isn't even present. For example, there's a scene between Ahab and his first mate, Starbuck, which takes place when they are alone in Ahab's cabin, and which is therefore written in a de facto third person. What's more, Ishmael doesn't develop in the way that characters in modern novels often do. He goes through some tremendous experiences, including the sinking of his ship and the death of everyone else in the story. But in the end, he's essentially the same person as he was at the beginning. There are no epiphanies for Ishmael. In The Great Gatsby, Nick Carraway takes much more of a role in the story than Ishmael does in Moby Dick. Nick is Daisy's cousin, his house is the site of Gatsby and Daisy's reunion, and he's present for many of the big scenes. But on the whole, he serves mainly as the recording eye for the story. Unlike the other major characters, Gatsby, Daisy, and Daisy's husband Tom, Nick has to work for a living, which makes him an outsider to the world he's depicting. He is able to record the story of the stinking rich characters around him with more objectivity and distance than Gatsby or Daisy could. Nick is certainly more engaged in the story than Ishmael is in Moby Dick. So the novel's famous last line, "So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past," represents Nick's epiphany and no one else's. But even so, he's still not essential to the playing out of the plot. He gives an intimate portrait of a man he knew personally, but from a slight remove. This, I think, is the hallmark of the slightly remote first-person narrator. He is not quite as remote as the third person and not quite as intimate as a more active first-person narrator. This kind of narrator allows you to feel you are witnessing the events of the novel firsthand, but with no pressure from the narrator to endorse a particular opinion of any of the characters or any of the actions in the story. A version of Moby Dick narrated by Ahab, or a version of The Great Gatsby narrated by Jay Gatsby, would require us to take sides for or against our narrator, which I personally think would have diminished the power of these two novels. So perhaps the objective and remote first-person narrator is especially effective when your central character is both charismatic and slippery, the way Ahab and Gatsby are. Ishmael and Nick Carraway allow us to get close, but not too close. Now let's talk about what I called, in my previous lecture, the subjective first-person, and let's break it down into several different varieties. The first variety is what I'm going to call the heroic narrator. This sort of narrator is usually the main character, or at least one of the main characters, and she takes an active role in the events of the story. In this case, the narration's evocation of her own character is equally important to telling the story. This sort of narrator has something in common with the objective first-person narrator. In both cases, the reader is invited to take the narrator at face value and assume that what she is telling you is the truth. But heroic narration takes this assumption a bit further and invites the reader to actively endorse the narrator's judgments of the other characters and situations in the story. We don't root for Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby because he's not the main character. Nick's slight remove from the action enables us to make up our own mind about Gatsby himself. But in Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, we are asked not only to assume that Jane is telling the truth throughout, but we are also actively encouraged to endorse Jane's judgments of the other characters and to root for her. In the book's wonderful first paragraph, which I quoted in an earlier lecture, we are encouraged to feel Jane's righteous anger at her mistreatment by her foster family. Later on, we are encouraged to sympathize with her feeling of betrayal when she discovers that Mr. Rochester is already married. And at the end, we are encouraged to feel her joy and triumph when she is finally able to marry him. Let me put this another way. In a story with a heroic narrator, there is not much difference between the narrator's opinion of the other characters and the author's. In some cases, and in some very good books, this can become a kind of wish fulfillment. For example, consider Philip Marlowe, the hard-boiled private investigator who is the main character and the narrator of the great detective stories of Raymond Chandler. At first glance, it might seem as if Marlowe is an objective first-person narrator, simply recording what he sees and hears. Listen to the first paragraph of Chandler's novel, The Long Goodbye. "The first time I laid eyes on Terry Lennox, he was drunk in a Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith outside the terrace of the dancers. The parking lot attendant had brought the car out and he was still holding the door open because Terry Lennox's left foot was still dangling outside, as if he had forgotten he had one. He had a young-looking face, but his hair was bone white. You could tell by his eyes that he was plastered to the hairline, but otherwise he looked like any other nice young guy who had been spending too much money in a joint that existed for that purpose and for no other." At first, this seems to be an objective bit of description that happens to be written in the first person. But if you listen carefully to Marlowe's voice, you realize that the narrator is passing judgment. Marlowe's voice is that of a cool, slightly weary man of the world. You can tell by listening to him that he has a lot of experience with people of all sorts, and that he can recognize when a man is drunk just by looking at his eyes. The kicker is the last part of the last sentence. Marlowe refers to the nightclub The Dancers not just as a joint, but as the sort of joint that exists for no other reason than to take money off nice young guys like Terry Lennox. This is a judgment. It tells us that Marlowe, and by proxy Chandler himself, accepts that he has to live in this crummy world, but he doesn't have to approve of it. As Marlowe moves through the rest of the novel, most of the story is about other people. But on every page, Marlowe continues to crack wise and make sharp judgments of everything and everybody around him. He makes mistakes, of course, but he usually recovers from them later on. And in nearly every scene, Marlo is the one in control, the one who understands what's really going on, and the one who gets off the best jokes. The distance between Philip Marlowe's view of the world and Raymond Chandler's is not very great. This kind of wish-fulfilling narration allows both the reader and the author to live through the narrator without any guilt or second thoughts. It allows us to move through an exciting story full of danger and intrigue as the coolest, smartest, and most righteous person in the room. Now let's take a look at a more complex version of the heroic first person. Let's return to one of the most famous narrators in literary history, namely Huck Finn in Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Huck is not only a superbly entertaining narrator, he's one of the great characters in American fiction. He is a plain-spoken, semi-literate, but verbally inventive boy who is by turns gullible and devious, resourceful and accident-prone, and who gets by on what today we would call street smarts. In fact, Huck implicitly warns the reader in the very first paragraph, not all of what follows may be true. What he says is, "I never seen anybody but lied one time or another." And indeed, throughout the book, Huck repeatedly uses lies to get himself out of trouble. Let's look at the ways in which Huck is a more complex narrator than Philip Marlowe. While Marlowe's narration certainly uses the slang and idioms of mid-20th century urban America, Huck's dialect is even more specific, representing rural Missouri in the years before the Civil War. Indeed, one of the greatest pleasures of reading the book is just being able to listen to the cadences, rhythms, and rich idioms of Huck's speech. But the more important reason that Huck is a more interesting narrator is that his boyish, semi-educated view of the world does not necessarily represent the views of his author. Huck is shrewd, wily, and fundamentally decent, but he's also young and immature and badly educated. His creator, however, is much more mature and better educated. The result is that Huck represents a classic example of what you might call the double consciousness of a first-person narrator. This is when a skilled writer evokes the beliefs and prejudices of his narrator, while at the same time letting the reader see through the narration to what's really going on. This double consciousness accounts for much of the humor in Huckleberry Finn. Some of the best passages are Huck's guileless descriptions of adult behavior that he doesn't understand. One such moment comes in Chapter 1, when the Widow Douglas, one of the prim and proper adults in Huck's life, tries to read to him from the Bible. "After supper, she got out her book and learned me about Moses and the bulrushers, and I was in a sweat to find out all about him. But by and by, she let it out that Moses had been dead a considerable long time. So then I didn't care no more about him, because I don't take no stock in dead people." Now, the humor in this passage comes from the double consciousness of the narration. On the one hand, we understand and maybe even sympathize with the boredom of a child who is being told a long, involved story about some old dead guy. On the other hand, Mark Twain is winking at us over Huck's shoulder, letting us know that he knows as well as we do that Huck is missing the point. More importantly, though, the double consciousness of Huckleberry Finn explicitly manifests itself at the moral climax of the book in Chapter 31. This is the moment when Huck has to decide whether to allow his friend, the slave Jim, to be sold back into slavery, or whether he should help Jim go free. Everything about the moral code of Huck's world, everything ever told to him by white teachers, ministers, and other authority figures, tells him that letting a slave run away is a kind of theft. Huck truly believes that sanctioning this theft will send him to hell. But then, in a heartfelt paragraph, he recalls fondly the way he and Jim looked after each other as they floated down the river. Finally, he says, in one of the most famous sentences in American literature, "All right, then, I'll go to hell." Then he says, "It was awful thoughts and awful words, but they was said, and I let them stay said, and never thought no more about reforming. I shoved the whole thing out of my head and said I would take up wickedness again, which was in my line, being brung up to it, and the other weren't. And for a starter, I would go to work and steal Jim out of slavery again. And if I could think up anything worse, I would do that too, because as long as I was in, and in for good, I might as well go the whole hog." There are three things, at least, going on in this thrilling paragraph. One is that Huck is simply telling us the story of his decision. Another is that Twain is allowing us to revel in the sheer pleasure of hearing Huck reason this out for himself in his own unique voice. But the most important thing is that Twain is peeking through his own character at this point. Twain is letting the reader know that Huck is doing the right thing, even if Huck himself doesn't know it. Remember, at this point, Huck really thinks he's consigning himself to eternal damnation. On the one hand, Twain stays absolutely true to his character. Huck sounds like Huck all the way through the passage, with his rough grammar, his folksy idioms, and his phonetic spellings. But on the other hand, Twain allows the reader to see through Huck and to understand the larger issue, which is the immorality of slavery. Huck comes down on the side of love versus the letter of the law. And even though we, as readers, may fault his reasoning, we can't fault his conclusion. Using Huck's own voice, Mark Twain allows us to see Huck and the world he lives in even more clearly than Huck himself could. Now, the very last paragraph of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn makes it clear that Huck is still a boy when he narrates his own story, and that his adventures have happened only in the recent past. This brings me to the next variety of the heroic first person, which I'm going to call retrospective narrator. One of the hallmarks of the retrospective narrator is that she is recalling events from her own life from a distance of many years. Unlike Huck Finn, she is looking back at herself when she was younger. But there's more to it than simply the distance in time. In this type of narration, the narrator is also expressing the emotional and intellectual distance between her younger self and the person she is now at the time she's narrating the story. There are many stories and books that fulfill the first requirement of this type of narration, but not the second. For example, Jane Eyre is looking back on her struggles as a young woman from the perspective of an older woman, happily married to Mr. Rochester, so her story fulfills the first requirement. But she doesn't really write very critically or objectively about herself as a younger woman. Remember, we're encouraged to root for Jane throughout the book, so her narration does not fulfill the second requirement. One of the best examples of the sort of narrator who does fulfill both requirements is the character Ruth in Marilyn Robinson's novel Housekeeping. Following in the footsteps of other classic American narrators such as Ishmael, Huck, and Nick Carraway, Ruth introduces herself directly to the reader in the first sentence. My name is Ruth. Then, with characteristically American directness, she goes on to summarize her backstory in a few words. I grew up with my younger sister Lucille under the care of my grandmother, Mrs. Sylvia Foster, and when she died, of her sisters-in-law, Mrs. Lily and Nona Foster, and when they fled, of her daughter, Mrs. Sylvia Fisher. The majority of the book is about how Ruth and Lucille, two young girls who have been either abandoned or orphaned by all the other adults in their family, end up being looked after by Sylvia, their very unconventional aunt. Sylvia has lived her adult life drifting from town to town, but for the sake of her nieces, she makes an attempt to create some stability for them in the family home in a small town in Idaho. But try as she might, Sylvia finally can't resist the pull of a restless life. In the end, the young Ruth chooses to run off with her aunt, while Lucille chooses to stay behind and live a more conventional life. The simplicity of this belies the dreamlike strangeness of this novel. It is told many years later by the grown-up Ruth, who is now a vastly different person from the young girl she had been. Unlike Jane Eyre, who starts as an outsider and achieves the conventional goals of marriage, security, and children, Ruth chooses, as Huck Finn puts it at the end of his book, to light out for the territory and live an unsettled life in the company of her strange aunt. In other words, Ruth is the opposite of Jane Eyre. She leaves a conventional life to become an outsider and writes her narrative from that perspective. She looks back on her childhood without regret or nostalgia, but instead with a kind of bemused, mysterious calm that passes no judgment. Written in limpid, poetic prose, Ruth's narration takes the reader on a spiritual journey that requires the reader to question the conventional wisdom about family life, about motherhood, and about the relations between sisters. Ruth's voice truly puts us in the head of someone very, very unusual. Her narration allows us to see a way of living we may not want to inhabit in real life, but which has the profound effect of showing us the world in a whole new light. There is also another kind of retrospective first-person narrator, namely one who looks back on his former self with disappointment or even contempt. In an earlier lecture, I talked about James Baldwin's novel Giovanni's Room, which is narrated by an American expatriate in Paris named David. As you may recall, David struggles with his sexuality throughout this brief novel. He is powerfully attracted to men, but he loves and hopes to marry a young American woman named Hella. The bulk of the story is about David's intense affair with a bartender named Giovanni. David lives with the man for a time, but he eventually leaves Giovanni in favor of Hella. David's rejection of Giovanni leads indirectly to Giovanni's murder of a bar owner and his execution. At the end of the book, Hella leaves David as well. Finally, David, in a last moment of cowardice, decides not to attend Giovanni's execution. David's narration is not told at a great distance in time from the events of the story. It is suffused throughout with David's mixed emotions about being gay, but most of all, his narration is dominated by his self-contempt for the way he treated Giovanni. As early as the end of the second chapter, David considers the fact that Giovanni will be rotting soon in unhallowed ground, and then he says, "Until I die, there will be those moments, moments seeming to rise up out of the ground like Macbeth's witches, when his face will come before me, that face in all its changes, when the exact timbre of his voice and the tricks of his speech will nearly scorch my ears, when his smell will overpower my nostrils." In fact, you might say that David is an anti-heroic narrator, but he still has something in common with a heroic narrator. In Jane Eyre, we are expected to take Jane's judgments of herself and the other characters at face value. By the same token, we are meant to take David's story at face value and to endorse his judgment of himself. It's just that in his case, we are meant to share his contempt for himself rather than endorse his heroism. This brings us to the unreliable narrator, or the sort of narrator who cannot be trusted by the reader. Unreliable first-person narrators come in several varieties. The simplest version is the narrator who is simply lying to the reader and who reveals his lies at the end. John Banville's novel Dr. Copernicus is a fictional account of the life of the famous astronomer. Most of the book is told in the close third person from Copernicus's point of view, but there is a fascinating section written in the first person by a scholar named Rheticus. This young scholar was a student of Copernicus, who, in the manner of ambitious students of famous teachers, is full of rage at Copernicus for all sorts of reasons. His chapter is full of pernicious gossip and severe criticisms of the older man. Only at the end of his section does Rheticus confess that a crucial element in his story was invented, which casts into doubt nearly everything else he said for the previous 60 pages. There is another kind of unreliable narrator, namely the one who lies to other characters in the story and often ends up deluding himself. The unnamed first-person narrator of Henry James's novella, The Aspern Papers, is a literary critic who is desperate to acquire some old love letters by a long-dead American poet named Jeffrey Aspern. These letters are in the possession of Aspern's former lover, now a very old woman. The narrator attempts to get the papers away from her by pretending to be romantically interested in the old woman's unattractive niece. It all goes wrong, of course. The critic's scam is discovered, and on the final page, the niece, who at last understands the game he was playing, tells the narrator she's burned the letters. Throughout the novella, the narrator has wrestled with his conscience, but in the end, he stifles it. In the very last line of the story, when he looks at a picture of the poet that hangs in his study, he says, "When I look at it, I can scarcely bear my loss. I mean, of the precious papers." Notice he says the loss of the papers, not the loss of his honor, his dignity, or any compassion for a lonely woman whose heart he broke. There is yet another sort of unreliable narrator, one who manages to delude both herself and the reader. The experience of reading Eudora Welty's hilarious story, Why I Live at the P.O., is like being cornered by a talkative and slightly unhinged woman. This narrator believes she has been wronged by her family and is determined to tell you her side of the story, whether you want to hear it or not. Here's the first paragraph. I was getting along fine with Mama, Papa Daddy, and Uncle Rondo until my sister Stella Rondo just separated from her husband and came back home again. Mr. Whitaker. Of course I went with Mr. Whitaker first when he first appeared in China Grove.